Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm really thrilled to have as my guest Mary Gaitskill, whose new book of stories, Don't Cry, has just come from Pantheon. You know, I have a very deep response to Mary Gaitskill's writing, and, you know, I feel that it's often so profound and so painful that I have to be sure that I read it when I'm capable of withstanding its battering. And then, to my surprise, when I read Don't Cry, I found an entirely new sort of story, several new kinds of stories for Mary Gaitskill, and a range, almost, I would say, like a collage of compassionate feeling that was new to me in the work, and I felt very, very grateful for it. Do you feel that these stories are new for you?
Well, first I want to say thank you for your appreciation of them. It's very kind of a relief to me, because a lot of people have talked about how violent and twisted and malformed the people in this book are, and it's a little disturbing and scary to me to hear that, because it doesn't seem that way. So I'm glad that you don't. They do seem different to me, although it's hard for me to analyze exactly how, because it would take a while for me to get a distance. I will say, though, that I've never experienced my work as brutal and uncompassionate as you just said. I never felt that the stories I did in the past were hard or anything like that, but maybe the softer qualities that I perceived in them, I could perceive because I was kind of working from them from the inside, and maybe the quality has come out more. So it's kind of more on the surface and visible than it was before.
Yes, I never found them brutal. I found them to be about the hardness of the world that makes us suffer. This is what good stories do. I mean, it's not a criticism of them. It's a recognition in a certain way that one of the things that writing does is that it puts us into an alternative framework, gives us access to the thing that we never can have, to know how another person feels. And sometimes the strangeness of that and the effort to stay external to a story. What I think happens in these newer stories is that the character is entered and then more and more deeply, so that the levels of compassion and concern seem to me to be almost supernatural in these stories, the new ones.
Well, thank you. I think that the effect of that may be partly because I'm older, and the more you experience of life. I remember we were talking about losing our parents, or you were talking about losing your parents?
My father, yeah.
I remember when my father died, this was a while ago now, it was 2001, as he didn't die quickly, I was with him, and it lasted a few weeks. And I was so astonished at the levels of feeling that I discovered in myself, which I really wasn't aware of. And I almost began to seem to me that people were like, this is a funny metaphor, but like cans almost, that a lot of substance was sort of squashed into, that the form of our personalities and characters is like this sort of small container for a lot of stuff that has to be compressed into this small thing, and we can only be aware of what's on the surface at any given time. But then something like that happens, something that's, it kind of forces the container to break a bit, something very, a deep life-altering event, and you suddenly, all these feelings and come to the surface that you weren't even aware that you had. And because of having that experience and also other things, it wasn't just my father's death, there have been other things that are complex to explain, but just becoming aware of all the different layers in myself and in other people, because once you see that in yourself, you begin to be aware of it in other people. I was able to create characters who are for the most part older people, and who, because they've experienced a death, as in Don't Cry or in The Little Boy, and also are in the process of trying to help a child in both stories, they're dealing with a lot of different experiences and emotional layers in themselves simultaneously.
I always wondered whether Chekhov's stories contained as many of what I'm calling a collage of different forms of compassion, because of his life as a doctor, that he came close to suffering early on, and that in a sense his life as a playwright was about calibrating different distances from suffering. And it's always seemed to me to be, you know, the extraordinary quality of Chekhov. And some of the stories, particularly Don't Cry, but The Little Boy as well, they seem to have that quality of being at different distances from the feeling centers of the characters and presented really lucidly.
That's a really beautiful way to describe Chekhov, I have to say.
Thank you. But here, there's actually a story. It was the first of the ones where I said, wow, this is, you know, I've never seen this before, not just in Mary Gateskill, The Mirrored Ball, where the souls of the characters are the central characters, and physical life is an adjunct to the behavior of souls. How did that story arrive? How did you do that?
Well, it actually, it was a story I was very uncertain of, and it found impossible to get published. It got published in a fashion magazine, or like a kind of a, I don't know how to characterize this magazine, but anyway, it started very superficially. A woman was talking to me about her relationship with some man, and a friend of hers had said, don't get involved with him, he will steal your soul. And it's a little bit of an old-fashioned phrase, but it stuck with my mind, and I thought, what would that look like if somebody literally took somebody's soul? And it's an idea that's both primitive and whimsical, and I think actually happens. I don't know if anyone can steal your soul. I doubt that's possible. And I was careful not to have it be her entire soul, because I think it would be arrogant and blasphemous to attempt to describe an entire soul. I don't have any idea what that would look like. That's beyond my mind, certainly. I think anyone's. But I thought I could do a piece of it. It's a small piece that he takes, but that's certainly enough. And I think that's something that, on one hand, it's a little bit of a goofy idea, the way I describe it, but it's also, I think people have that experience all the time where they, not just in sex, but you feel in some interaction that someone's taken something from you. And if it happens often enough, you begin to feel very bereft and unmoored. And that's what I was writing about. And also, yeah, I think that, again, that there's visible life that we see and that we can identify, that's the personality, the things we have to do to survive, the social structure. And then deeper than that, the psychological structure, the more primitive motors that drive us. And then there's something stranger than that, that's beneath that, that I think is invisible to us most of the time.
And it's, to my mind, a really astonishing story. Some people have chosen to describe it as a fairy tale, and the words fairy tale occur in the story. But I really think that it is a essential story about the essence of behavior as it reaches that bottomless, unarticulate place inside us where our unknown feelings reside, the things that generate us.
Yeah, it's what I was calling the unknown, the luminous unknown, which is connected to emotions, but isn't exactly the same as emotion. It's almost sub-emotional, and yet it becomes present through human emotions.
In one of the stories here, description, there's a writer who has learned from his teacher that the description of the physical world is part of the spiritual presence of character. And another writer who is rejecting that as being unnecessary and preposterous, that all that needs to be registered is the actions between people, what they do in the world. And I felt when I was reading it that level of perception is very much in your work, and that it must be odd to read stories that have consciously rejected the possibility of depth.
Well, it's an interesting discussion. I think there's a lot of different ways to access depth, and some people do it through mostly through action and dialogue, but it is odd to me when people, it's as if people have forgotten the physical world exists and how numinous it is and how mysterious it is. I just started reading Blake, and there's a part in that little line in the Proverbs of Hell from the Marriage of Heaven and Hell where he says something like the world, the body, and the soul are, the body is an expression of the soul, and one of the ways we experience the soul is through the five senses in this world as it is now. I'm paraphrasing very roughly. And that's people sometimes, when you talk about describing the physicality of the character's existence, they act as if you're just wanting to set the scene or to do something very boring, basically, and locate the character in their world and blah, blah, blah. But it's not. That's not all it is. It's acknowledging the vastness and strangeness of the place that we are. Not everybody's going to write with a lot of description. Chekhov's Lady with the Dog doesn't have a lot of it. It has it where it counts. But, that's something that's a way in which I find myself at odds with a lot of how other people like to teach writing.
But I would say at odds with a lot of the way people choose to live in the world. That's what hurts, that somehow the world, which once was a place that was perhaps made for the possibility of human perception and human depth, became in some sense in our time a demolition derby to do the most damage the most quickly. And, that is the pain. And when we go and find things in great art that remind us of the other aspect, and, that's, for me, the great, almost spiritual joy of reading, to recover access to the better place.
Well, it's, I think part of it's an effect of how we live now. We're very dephysicalized. Like in the story that you were mentioning earlier, In the Ravine by Chekhov, the young woman whose baby has just been killed walks back to where she lives, holding her dead child through a dark forest. And she's surrounded by sounds and can barely see, and then when she encounters people, she hears their voices first and sees their face lit up with a match. Nobody would experience that now in this culture. She would be in a cab and be whisked to a grief center, probably.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Mary Gateskill, author most recently of Don't Cry, published by Pantheon. We'll continue after this short break. ¶¶ I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Mary Gateskill about her book of stories, Don't Cry. I thought it would be meaningful for listeners to hear the beginning of the story, Mirrored Ball, because it is a story that proceeds to the depths.
He took her soul, though being a secular-minded person, he didn't think of it that way. He didn't take the whole thing. That would not have been possible. But he got such a significant piece of it that it felt as if her entire soul were gone. As soon as he had it, he not only forgot that he'd taken it, he forgot he'd ever known about it. This wasn't the first time, either. He was a musician, well-regarded in his hometown and little known anywhere else. This fact sometimes gnawed at him, and yet was sometimes a secret relief. He'd seen musicians get sucked up by fame, and it was like watching a frog get stuffed into a bottle, staring out with its face, its splayed legs, its private beating heart distorted and revealed against the glass. Fame, of course, was bigger and supposedly more fun than a bottle, but still, once you were behind the glass and blown up huge for all to see, there you were. It would suddenly be harder to sit and drink in the anonymous little haunts where songs were alive and moving in the murky darkness, where a girl might still look at him and wonder who he was, and he might wonder about her. It was at one of these places that he met her. She was drinking with a friend of a friend. She was slim and elfin, with dark hair, long fingers, and tapered fingernails. She held her drink as if she held a bit of liquid flame. She smiled at him. He smiled back. The friend of a friend started talking about a movie she had seen, a complicated fantasy in which a hero and heroine fall into a hidden world running parallel to ours and discover that the two worlds are on a collision course. The elfin girl punched him lightly on the hip. "We should go," she said. There was a loud crash behind the bar. They both started and turned to look. They turned back to face each other at the same time. They went to a movie that weekend and then to a bar afterward. It must be said that she should not have shown him her soul. She flashed it again and again as if it were a bauble meant to entice him or a hand mirror flashing signals from a dark and lonely place. Everybody knows about dark and lonely places, he thought. Why was she sending these signals without knowing who he was and if he cared to read them? Still, her constant flashing was dramatic and attractive. Images from the movie they had just seen hovered about her. A woman in black strode through the city with a gun. A woman in white fell on her knees before a killer. The camera lingered on her terrified face. The hero pounded on the door. The girl's eyes flashed like her bright, nervous soul.
Mary Gateskill, reading from the beginning of Mirror Ball. That's beautiful. Finally, two stories, The Little Boy and the final one, Don't Cry, are in different ways about rescuing a child. And it seemed as if that act had become a metaphor or a symbol for the acts of compassion that these stories make. I know that you don't have a child, but the quality seen in the little boy, a woman seeing a boy being indifferently treated and then mistreated by his single parent, his mother, seems to be able to see in him so many qualities and to articulate them, both for herself and for the boy. And again, there's the through the rabbit hole effect at the beginning of the story, of going through a magic tunnel. It's in the airport. The lights are flashing. The woman is moving slowly. It's almost as if these light and color and sound effects in these stories mirror a transition state between realms of recognition.
It wasn't something I said about doing consciously, but that makes sense. I don't have children, and I don't know how much I can convey of this, but for many years, my husband and I have had a relationship with a couple of children that we got to know through the Fresh Air Fund. Do you know what that is?
Yes, but tell.
I don't think they have it out here. So it's an organization I'm a little ambivalent about in terms of its concept. But the idea is that kids are taken out of poor inner city neighborhoods. They're usually Black or Latino, although not always. They're usually Russian kids mixed in. And they're sent on a bus out to stay with, you don't have to have money to be a Fresh Air Fund host family. You know, that's not an object. You just have to live in the country. So
I grew up in being a big brother or a pal. There were many different versions of this possibility, you know, taking someone to a park and playing ball with them or, you know, but this was bringing people to the country, as I remember.
And also that not all the host families are white and not all of them are tremendously affluent, but they tend to be. And so that's, I guess, my reservation is you put these tiny children on a bus with a name tag around them and send them out to stay with these total strangers who just happen to be white as sheets. And I mean, when I thought about it, would I at the age of 8 want to get on, let alone 6, want to get on a bus and be greeted by strange people grinning at me and they just happen to have more than I've ever seen in my life and they're totally different than me? And I think I'd hate it, actually. Anyway, nonetheless, without thinking it out terribly, this is what we did. And the child that I met that way, though, I really fell in love with. He was only 6 years old, and it was a very difficult thing because we only meant to have one kid, but we wound up, and he was a different child than the one that I fell in love with, Chris. But we had two of these boys who hated each other, and it was a really complex situation. But the 6-year-old, the young one, Chris, I was just became very profoundly attached to him. And I wrote to him afterwards. His mother, I learned, didn't speak English or read even Spanish. I knew she didn't speak English, so I got somebody to translate the letters into Spanish, and I learned she didn't read. His sister read them, though, and read them to him. And so when I called, I got to know his sister as well, and we developed a quite long-term relationship with them. And it was I can't really describe it all on right now, but the mother was someone who, by most standards, was abusive, especially to the girl. She prefers the boy. But has a very hard life. She works brutally hard, doesn't make any money, and she's alone, and she lives in a neighborhood that scares her, that's not a Latino neighborhood. It was a very interesting experience because she's somebody that on paper, if I read about her, I would just condemn absolutely because she hits her kids and tells the girl she's worthless and fat and ugly nonstop. It brags about it to us. Maxielle flunked and I grabbed her hair and smashed her head on the wall. And she was, you know, thought this was something we would approve of. And I know it's horrible. And yet when I've been with her, with the translator or not, you know, I can describe it, but I feel her in a way that makes it impossible for me to judge her. It's like I'm just very aware. I don't even know how to describe it, but just when I physically sit with her, I'm just so aware of how I cannot really understand her. And if you can't understand somebody, you can't judge them. You may judge their actions, but that's different. And I see she actually loves the kids.
Mm.
Especially him. I'm not so sure about the girl, but she's very attached to them. And they're attached to her. They love her deeply and are profoundly sympathetic with her. I mean, it's almost like they're taking care of her. And anyway, so that relationship has been what's enabled me to understand more how one can feel about seeing a child that needs help, and you may be able to help them somewhat, but you're limited. and also you're limited by your ability to understand, and that children in those situations actually have also their own power. They're not helpless beings. The little boy in the story is someone who the woman correctly perceives has a lot of strength. He just needs the help in unfurling it, and he needs love to feed it. And also the Don't Cry story, which is about adoption in Ethiopia. I mean, I've never done that, but my experience has given me some understanding of what it's like to negotiate both a bureaucracy, which makes no sense, which we've encountered over and over again, both with the Fresh Air Fund and the schools and the social working systems, and also a language, a cultural and language barrier. A woman comes from a different country, doesn't speak English. Really hard to make the connections and find a way to be understood and understand. And you just kind of at some point have to go out there in the dark and hold your hand out.
Mm. Yeah. Mary, I want to thank you. I mean, you've really given me an extraordinary picture of what's happened in these stories, and to you as a writer. I mean, these stories really do register a feeling zone that seems to have been made accessible to you for expression. And I think it's remarkable and wonderful.
Well, thank you very much.
I really appreciate it. I've been talking with Mary Gaitskell, author most recently of Don't Cry, published by Pantheon. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Don't Cry at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.